Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport for a talk by William Reinch, who holds the Skoll Chair in International Business at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And he is a senior advisor at Kelly, Dry and Warren LLP. The title of today's talk is Globalization, Inequality, and Trade Policy. William Reinch previously served for 15 years as president of the National Foreign Trade Council. He also served as a member of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission from 2001 to 2016. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is George Look, president of the Mid-Coast Forum.
I want to welcome you to the 427th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. A warm welcome both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Northport, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and the factors influencing them. We are now in our 36th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. To listen to past forum presentations, find out about upcoming forum programs, and find out how to become a forum member, visit our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, we are very pleased to have with us Mr. William Reinch, who will be addressing globalization, inequality, and trade policy. William Reinch holds the Skoll Chair of International Business at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He is also a senior advisor at Kelly, Dreyer, and Warren LLP. Previously, he served for 15 years as the president of the National Foreign Trade Council. While in that position, he led work on many issues, including efforts in favor of open markets, in support of the Import-Export Bank and Overseas Private Investment Corporation, against unilateral sanctions, and in support of sound international tax policy. From 2001 to 2016, he concurrently served as a member of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. In addition, Mr. Reinch is an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, where he teaches courses on globalization, trade policy, and politics. Mr. Reinch served as the Undersecretary of Commerce for Export Administration during the Clinton administration. Prior to that, he spent 20 years on Capitol Hill, most of them as senior legislative assistant to the late Pennsylvania Senator John Heinz, and then to West Virginia Senator John D. Rockefeller IV. Mr. Reinch has a bachelor's degree from Johns Hopkins University and a master's degree from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, both in international relations. Bill, a warm welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, and particularly thank you for introducing me as having gone to Johns Hopkins rather than John Hopkins. This is, for those of you that know the university, that's a point of great sensitivity for alumni, and so I'm very proud of George for having gotten it right. There's a famous story that Milton Eisenhower, who was our president when I was a student there, was once introduced in Pittsburgh as the president of Johns Hopkins University, and he stood up and said, "Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here in the city of Pittsburgh," and made the point that way. It's a real honor for me to be with you. This is an organization that has great history and great stature, and actually it's going to be very intimidating because so many of you probably know more than I do about the subject matter, and I have done that before and often lose, because people will come up, particularly during the question period, to embarrass me with what they know and I don't know. But that's fine. Plus, I have George here who's going to work his way through the questions and only ask me the easy ones, I'm hoping. What I'm going to do is a little bit of history, actually. And by a little bit, I'm going to do 10,000 years in about 3 minutes. And then talk about more or less how we got where we are now, what people think about where we are now, about cognitive dissonance, which is the capacity of people to have hold two contradictory views at the same time, which is what you see a good bit of in trade. What I'm going to save for Q&A will be comments about our president and his trade policy and what's going to happen in pick your country. And I'm happy to do that. That's what I spend most of my professional life doing. But I thought for purposes of the presentation, I'd make some comments and have some pictures here for the people that are in the room that are a little bit more focused on history and how we got where we are and where we are. And then we'll go from there into more specifics. The 10,000 years of history is that briefly, you know, we started out thousands of years ago in an environment where people went to the food. We had a hunter-gatherer culture, and if you wanted to eat, you went out and found it, and you generally ate it where you found it. Agriculture came along, you know, 8,000 years ago or so, probably a little bit more than that. And that was significant because that brought the food to the people. And you grew the food next to where you were. And for a long time, that was the way our society was based. It wasn't just food. You made your own clothes, or maybe the person next door to you made clothes, but you didn't go very far away. And that was true until about 1820. And then things started to happen. The invention of steam power, and first in the textile industry, but more importantly in transportation, enabled what an author named David Baldwin has described as the first unbundling, which was a separation of production from consumption. So instead of spinning your own yarn and making your own clothes, it was a factory 50 miles up the road in England that made it, and you could go to the town market and buy it. But that separation created, it was transforming in thing ways that people don't think about. Farmers, for the most part, you know, got up when it got light. They went out and worked in the fields. If it rained, they didn't. There were a lot of holidays, particularly before the Reformation, a lot of saints' days where people had celebrations or didn't work. When you had factories, all of a sudden you had to clock in. You know, the looms were running, people had to be there to tend them. You had to show up a certain hour, you had to work a certain number of hours, and then you had to live a certain number of days. It was transforming in the way people live. We take all this for granted, but if you think about it back then, it was extraordinary. The first unbundling was separating production from consumption, which of course, if you think about that, always produces trade. Because what happens immediately is that there are other people making stuff you want. And so if you want to get it, you've got to have something to give them. So trade, sometimes domestic, sometimes international. What enabled this to go further were extraordinary reductions in the cost of transportation and communication due to technological progress. So we went from steam to electricity to you name it, things would go faster and faster, which meant basically that goods could move faster and faster. They could move from, you know, instead of by horseback and cart, they could move by train. They could move by ship, and then they could move by steamship, which was faster. Then they could move by airplane. And now in a world of digital trade, they move, things move electronically, not necessarily goods, but a lot of other stuff moves electronically and instantaneously, which has spoiled us all. There are a few of you in this audience, I think, who may be my age, and you will remember, you know, the complexities and the cost of making an international call in the 50s and 60s. And now that's, you know, if you use Skype, it's sort of virtually free. Technology has allowed these things to happen, and this has been enabling for production and manufacturing, because it's allowed companies that make stuff to have a lot more options. And one thing it's allowed them to do that we are all seeing the fruits of now in a supply chain world is to separate production from consumption, move workers around the globe, and in the last unbundling, in Baldwin's mind, basically, has enabled us to separate know-how from production. That means that we have the technology here about how to make an advanced product, how to make a semiconductor chip, for example, which is complicated. One of the things we can do is we can, via thanks to the internet, we can ship it to Singapore so they can make one there, or make thousands of them there. This has led to what Baldwin regards, and I think he's right, the unbeatable combination of rich country technology and poor country labor. And rich country technology and poor country labor will beat every time rich country technology and rich country labor, and it will beat every time poor country technology and poor country labor. So it's enabled a marriage that has allowed us to produce all kinds of wonderful things at cheap prices, at a cost, because the cost has been jobs here. And the jobs are cost not simply because of trade and products going back and forth. A lot of the jobs are lost as a product of productivity improvements and the technology improvements that we've been talking about. So we have entered into, well, not we're not entered, we are well into a world of global value chains, which I'm going to talk about and illustrate in a few minutes, where, as one person told me, I had this fascinating talk at one point with a guy who invented the VCR and then proceeded to lose manufacturing of it to the Japanese. And his comment was, everything is made everywhere. And what he meant is what companies have done is to disaggregate the production process in ways that define the most efficient producer at the lowest cost with the best delivery schedule of each individual component. And then you put all that together. So as you'll see later, a car, for example, made by Ford or General Motors will often go back and forth across the Canadian border 7 times before it's finished, because it is cheaper and more efficient for Ford to ship the car to Ontario to have certain things added, ship it back to the United States to have other things added, and then ship it back to Ontario again. And people think it's sort of counterintuitive. Why don't they just have a big plant in Dearborn and do it all there? And the answer is because it is cheaper to do it the other way. And the reason it is cheaper to do it the other way is because of the low cost of transportation and the ability to move technology and know-how from place to place so that you can disseminate the capabilities that you need. So that is the kind of world we live in today, which is very different from before. There are some signs, incidentally, that that's a world that is changing. The McKinsey Global Institute did a very interesting study in the spring that looked at this and concluded that a couple things. First, that the rate of growth of trade in goods was declining, not an absolute decline, but the rate of growth was declining. But that was more than offset by the rate of growth of trade in services, which was ballooning, and the rate of growth in digital transmissions. And the economies were transforming. The other thing they concluded was that other large emerging economies, which is code for China and India, were finally beginning to do what economists have been telling them to do for years, which is develop consumption-led growth models domestically rather than export-led growth models. In other words, try to build your economy by getting more people in your country to spend on more stuff. The Chinese saving rate is still, I think in the 40% range. And this was finally beginning to happen. One of the consequences of that will be, at least statistically, less trade, because there'll be more domestic consumption. And what the Chinese are doing is building a lot of supply chains, just like I was talking about, but they're building them inside the country. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it shows up in statistics as less trade. And so you have to kind of dig down beneath the statistics to get a sense of what's happening. The other thing that seems to be happening, and we'll know more about this in a year or two, is the regionalization of trade. For a long time, the easy decision is let's go to China, let's go to Vietnam for apparel, let's go to Bangladesh because apparel is a labor-intensive item and they have cheap labor, so let's do that. There are problems with doing that. There are political problems. Not all of these countries are stable. They also don't maintain the same health, safety, and environmental standards that we would like to see our products be built, our product specifications be adhered to. And it's not always, as transportation costs fluctuate, it may end up not always being the most efficient thing to do. So there's a slight trend now toward regional supply chains, which means for the United States, Mexico will probably be the big winner. So will Canada in some respects, but primarily Mexico. In Southeast Asia, for a variety of reasons, people are leaving China, partly because of our tariffs, but also because Chinese wage rates are going up. The Chinese have a very interesting population structure. Thanks to their one-child policy, they're the biggest country in the world, and they're going to run out of workers because they have a population curve. You know, if you've seen these graphs of sort of these bulges of different age cohorts, the Chinese graph is looking like this. There's more and more old people, and there's not as many young people as in other societies. They're also going to be overtaken by India. By the current estimate is 2026, India will be the largest country in the world in terms of people. So people are leaving China, they're going to Vietnam. And that is still a regional supply chain. So this is where we are, this is where 10,000 years of history have brought us. And there have been a lot of consequences here for the United States. The main one is, and I realized, I think some of these are out of order, so I'm going to be skipping around. The main one is the trade is a lot more important for the United States than it used to be. We are historically an insular country. We're far away from everybody except for Canada and Mexico. We've got two oceans that separate us. We have a lot of history that made us suspicious of the sneaky Europeans in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And you can see even in a relatively short period of 30-odd years, however, this is beginning to change. So trade as a percentage of our GDP is 27% 2 years ago, whereas 30 years ago it was 17%. And you can expect that trend, I think, to continue to grow gradually. You can also see growth in foreign investment, both inbound and outbound, as we developing the supply chains I talked about necessitates making investments overseas. So there's been a huge outflow of American investment over the years. Holdings of foreign securities are way up. You see a sensitive political issue right now, an increase in immigration in this country. And to me, the most extraordinary change is the change in cross-border data flows, which is now at a number that I'm trying to calculate. It's gone from 4.7 terabits per second. A terabit is a trillion bytes per second. So it's gone from 4.7 of those to 211.3 of those in a relatively short period of time. The globe is becoming a digital economy as more and more stuff is not only ordered, delivered, and made digitally, but even manufactured digitally. Think about 3D printing, for example, where the real issue there is the code that goes into the machine to produce the thing that you want. And we did a study on this at CSIS, and interesting things, we opened with a guy who printed a house. And so those of you who think it's this little box that you go to the store, you could print a little keychain thing. Yes, that's true, but you can print a house. And the next thing he's gonna do is go to El Salvador and print a whole village, which I think is cool. This is transformative, and think about what that's going to do to the assembly line 20 years from now. If you can build it on site, you order a printer. And one of the things that NASA is doing, for example, is they're gonna include printers in space missions. So if something fails, they can print a new one because Amazon doesn't deliver to the moon. You want to do that. But that's going to be common, not normal. This kind of, one of the illustrations of the way that trade has transformed itself over the years is the development of containers. And the big things that look like big containers, what can I say? In the good old days, you had to load stuff aboard ship, item by item, barrel by barrel, box by box. Now you dump it all in containers. You've seen this. I'm sure you have this in Maine. These giant cranes that lift the containers off the truck directly onto the boat. The boat goes where it's going. There's another crane lifts it off the boat directly onto a truck. The truck takes it off to the plant. And you can see that we've gone from effectively zero containers in 1960 to 21 million 20-foot equivalent units in 2017. That has been transformative in the way that our trade works. And the result of that is that trade has become a larger part of our economy. As I said before, the trade as a percent of GDP is up and down. Everything goes, every chart you'll ever see has this giant dip in 2008. You all know the reason why for that. But you can see that we tend to be on an upward trend as far as trade is concerned as the American economy becomes more and more integrated. Before you get too excited about that, you have to realize that trade, relatively speaking, is tiny compared to the movement of money, which is also something that America is good at. So total world GDP is $76 trillion last year. Total world exports are $20.9 trillion. Currency turnover in the year is, what is that, one quadrillion, $849 trillion. You know, the movement of money, the movement of currency, dwarfs everything that's going on in the goods economy. And if you work for a bank, or used to work for a bank, you probably know this already, but it helps put these things in perspective.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features William Reinsch addressing globalization, inequality, and trade policy.
Now, when I was talking about supply chains, I want to just illustrate that for a minute. One of the things I said was that an automobile will go back and forth seven times before it's finished. This particular picture for our radio audience is a picture of a rear axle suspension assembly from Chevy Equinox. And what it illustrates are the 10 different American locations where a piece of this assembly is made, and the 6 different Canadian locations where a piece of this assembly is made. And the assembly moves around to the plants. The plants don't just send their parts to Dearborn. Well, in the GM case, it may not be Dearborn. But it's an example of the way that our economy has evolved. Another example that is illustrative is if you look at the Boeing 787, you see the same thing. The parts are made all over the world. And this is an interesting case because in the case of the automobile, they do it that way because it's efficient and because they can save money, because they've discovered that it's the best way to meet their criteria. Lowest price, highest quality, on-time delivery. Boeing's problem is a little bit different because they're selling to a government market for the most part. Most airlines are state-owned airlines, not in this country, but in most countries. And if you go into China and say, or Japan, they started this, and say, we want to sell airplanes to JAL or Japan Air, the response is, well, we'd like to buy your airplanes, but we want you to manufacture it in Japan. And Boeing says, well, we're not going to do that. But they'll say, we make part of it in Japan. And then there's a negotiation about what part. And Boeing will offer to make the seats and the bulkheads. And the Japanese will say, no, we want the wing, which is a high-tech product, or we want the avionics. And then there's a negotiation. And you end up with technology transfer. So what Boeing has to live with is a supply chain that is not necessarily the most efficient, and is not necessarily the least cost, but is the one that is necessary to open the markets that they want to sell planes to. And if you're talking about a very large market like China, which is going to buy hundreds of airplanes over the next 20 years, this matters. These are not one-off sales. Now, lest you think that this is all about manufacturing and hardware, you know, this is a picture of the Nutella supply chain. I assume everybody knows what Nutella is. But if you think about it, you know, they don't grow palm oil in Italy, They don't grow a lot of sugar in Italy, and they don't grow the ingredients for, they don't grow cocoa in Italy. Apparently they do grow hazelnuts, although they get, most of those come from Turkey. So even a relatively simple agricultural product like Nutella has to, it has a supply chain. And in this case, it's one of necessity. And this would go back hundreds of years. You know, if you want a product that has chocolate, sugar, hazelnuts in it, you're going to have to deal with other countries because not everybody makes all of those things. Now, an illustration of the implications of supply chains are in how supply chain can be deceptive are in value. And I want to talk for a minute about one of these. I'm holding up an iPhone for the audience. And the story of the iPhone is that in our customs rules, this is a product of China. So when it comes in the example that I'm showing, let's assume, I mean, there are different models, and this is a little out of date, but let's assume the retail price of the one I'm holding up is $500, okay, and that the price on entry is $179. When that product comes into the country, it is listed as an import from China, and it adds $179 to our trade deficit with China because that's the value that's attached to it when it arrives. However, of that $179 of value, only $6.50 is really Chinese because all the Chinese did was put it all together. All the parts came from somewhere else. The IP that underlies all this came from the United States. Other pieces, the glass, you know, a number of the chips came from Germany, Korea, Japan, or a bunch of other places. So I think experts estimate that if we counted value rather than final assembly in our customs rules, our actual trade deficit with China would probably be between 25 and 35% less than it is now. But we don't do that. But we may do that, actually. The World Trade Organization and the OECD, the Organization of Developed Countries, are together working on a project to try to figure out a better way to measure trade and measure trade flow. So you basically, these countries want to know what's going on, and they would like to know where the value is. Now, if you think about it, you realize that from the United States perspective, if we reorganized and counted stuff by value, it wouldn't make a difference in our overall deficit. So what would happen if we counted the iPhone differently is our deficit with China would go down, but our deficits with Germany, Korea, Japan, and everybody else would go up because we would be counting their parts and components separately as part of the import. So the net total is the same, but the difference of the pieces it would be different, and that's important because it helps us know where trade is how our trade is growing, and who we're dependent upon for different pieces. So stay tuned for the WTO and the OECD to produce something. Now, this is not just happening in the United States. This is happening everywhere. And one of the things the United States is confronting is the fact, not so much that we're declining, because I don't think we are declining, but other people are catching up. And it's one of the things that our policymakers have to deal with. So in 2000, this is a measurement of basically share of the global economy. So in 2000, the OECD countries, which basically are the rich countries, had around 60% of global GDP. 9 years ago, 2010, it was just about 50-50. 10 or so years from now, in 2030, the poorer countries will have 57% of global GDP. So what's going on is there's a reallocation of product, reallocation of production, reallocation actually of wealth in favor of the emerging economies, not because we're getting worse, but because other people are catching up, which is actually something that our policy has been designed to encourage for the last 70 years. We want to encourage growth. The idea is that growth is good, and if countries are trading with each other, then they're probably not fighting with each other, China and the United States apparently being an exception right now. But you know, that growth is good, but it does have consequences, and that's what we'll be talking about. There's been a lot of discussion about what does all this mean, and this gets into the political part of trade, which is going to be the last part of what I'm talking about. What does this mean for workers? the fact that all these changes are taking place. And what it means for workers is a mixed bag. It is good for companies, it's good for consumers because lower prices, and you get stuff faster. It's not good for all retailers. My wife has stopped going to stores, and she orders everything on Amazon. So I come home and there's all these boxes on our front porch. Stuff arrives faster. I don't entirely agree to participate in all this. I like to try on my shoes before I buy them, but she doesn't. What appears to be the case is that high-skilled workers benefit because we are a high-skilled economy. We are an economy where our intellectual property really is our primary competitive advantage. Low-skilled workers, it's a little uncertain. There's a lot of people that are losing their jobs to technology as these things disappear. The worst case that everybody's worried about is I have to say if because I'm a skeptic, if and when we end up with a world of autonomous vehicles, what's going to happen to the 3 million truck drivers that we've got? That's going to be a huge issue if that happens, a huge issue for employment. Workers who perform routine tasks are the ones that most are at risk because they can be replaced. When I was teaching globalization, I think last year, we had a guy come in and talk about the future of work, and he was talking about not only autonomous vehicles and all these other things. He said, think about robotics and think about, 20 years from now, when you stay in a hotel room and you check out, your hotel room is not going to be cleaned by somebody who comes upstairs with a little cart and a spray bottle. It's going to be cleaned by a robot, and the robot's going to be controlled in Sweden with somebody with a little stick that moves the robot around. So don't assume that the ability to roboticize, if that's a word, things is going to be limited by the nature of work. It may not be as limited by the nature of work as one thinks. That's sort of looking ahead. What this means for our economy is a little bit different. And this is the graph that I think that I use a lot, which is key. Basically, what this shows is that we are making as much stuff as we ever made, but we're doing it with a lot fewer workers. And you can see that you can see that while there's a big dip in production in 08 and 09, we are back nearly to the peak of our manufacturing, which was before that. But while the number of workers is coming back slightly, it is way down. It's been going down. We've been losing this particular chart only goes back to 1990. We've been losing manufacturing workers since the 70s. This is nothing new. It is in part due to trade, but it is also due to a bunch of other things. And that creates a whole bunch of people that are not in those jobs anymore. And they're cranky. This is why we have a political issue. You can look at the same thing in terms of income. This particular graph divides income up by ethnicity, but if you look at the everybody line, which happens to be the purple line, what you see is that median household income, which would be family of four income in the United States, in 2017 was back roughly where it was in 1999. In 2018, it's a little bit above. So in other words, for 18 years, our families made no wage progress at all. In fact, their wages were down relative to 1999. We are now, after 18 years, roughly back where we were then. This is not good news, because this means even people that are working, people that have jobs, are not necessarily happy, because they're not better off than they were then. So wages have stagnated, and jobs have been declining, and this is what I think has produced a lot of ferment in our electorate. And those are the last few comments I want to make. When you talk about what people think about trade today, I used the terms cognitive dissonance before. People tend to have two different attitudes about trade. They simultaneously think it's good and bad. And third, they also tend to think that other things are more important, which is a really important issue because that affects, you know, how they vote. So in the first case, you know, most Americans pretty consistently over the last 6 or 7 years have thought that trade is an opportunity for growth rather than a threat. And currently about 70% of the American people think trade is an opportunity and only 25% think that it's a threat. So that's pretty optimistic. But then if you begin to drill down, you get slightly different results. Second, if you ask them about trade agreements, well, this is financial situation. I'll get to trade agreements. We don't need to talk about that one. If you ask them on whether it's a bad thing because it lowers wages and trade is a bad thing because it lowers wages and costs, or whether it's a good thing because it provides opportunities for growth, you get a different number here. And you get more people saying it's a bad thing than it's a good thing, even though a lot of those people were the same people that 2 charts ago said that it was a good thing. Now, part of this is because of what I said a minute ago, which is that if you ask a different question, which is not what do you think about trade, which you can ask in, you know, a dozen different ways, instead ask what's important, you know, what's the biggest problem the American people have, trade is number 7. In other charts, it's number 11. It's usually the second one from the bottom. Sadly, from my perspective, the bottom is usually climate change. And the reality is that the American people are, the big three in terms of problems have consistently for some years been terrorism, strengthening the nation's economy, and healthcare. And they alternate number 1. In 2017, terrorism was at the top of the list. I think this year it's healthcare. But it doesn't, it's always one of those three. Trade is at the bottom. What that means is that when people vote, they're voting about the big three. They're not voting about trade. There's probably a half a dozen congressional districts in this country where the candidate will win or lose based on how he votes on the new NAFTA. But that's a half dozen. You know, in most cases, the debate is going to be on these other subjects. And you can see that, I think, in the debate of the presidential candidates and how much time was spent on other issues than trade. Of course, one of the reasons that is because the Democrats don't know what to say about trade, which is another reason why there's not a lot of talk about it. And you can see the dilemma that both parties have. If you ask about trade agreements, which is a little bit different than asking about trade, but that's what people get to vote on, are trade agreements, you can see that Democrats have consistently, nobody thinks this because you all think about the speeches that get given and you all think about what some of the candidates are saying, but Democrats have consistently said trade agreements are a good thing. And right now 73% of them say that trade agreements are a good thing and only 15% say that they're a bad thing. And this has been, you know, there's a slight dip in 09 and there's a larger dip during the election year in 2016. But on the whole, it's been positive, and it's trending even more positive. The Republicans have been a different story, which is a fascinating story. Historically, they have also said trade is a good thing. And then when Donald Trump came along, and he said trade was a bad thing, or trade agreements were bad things, they followed his lead. And so you see that Republican opinion about trade, that it was a bad thing, spiked in 2016 and 17. And that view is now beginning to recede a little bit, but it is still not where the Democrats, even this year, still not back to as strong as where the Democrats are. What this means in practical terms is that you have a country where there is a significant divide between politicians, between the elected officials and their voters. Democratic politicians are much less pro-trade than Democratic voters. Republican politicians are much more pro-trade than Republican voters. So why isn't this corrected in the election? It's not corrected in the election because people vote on other things. So you can get away with it. The Republicans' problem is most Republicans are intuitively and inherently free traders. You know, they grew up in the 80s and 90s. They grew up under Ronald Reagan, who articulated a free trade policy. He didn't always practice it, but he articulated a free trade policy. They believe in it. They have a president who does not. And they understand that his base is their base, And if they want to win, they need to climb aboard the train. The Democrats' problem is a base that is fairly pro-trade. This is a good example. This one explains why. A base that's pro-trade, because the most pro-trade part of our country are young people and minorities, particularly Latinos. That's the base of the Democratic Party in the countrywide. So if you're a Democrat, you're thinking, maybe I should vote this way. At the same time, the Democrats, as you know, have a very strong, long-lasting relationship with organized labor, which supplies significant financial and organizational support for them in campaigns. And that's a hard relationship to break. And the organized labor has made trade skepticism really its highest priority for the last 15 or 20 years. I don't quite understand why. And it didn't used to be that way. But it has been that way through the last two or three labor leaders. So the Democrats have a tie that the elected officials find difficult to break because they're the beneficiaries of the financial and organizational support. Yet at the same time, they know that, you know, the base of their voters are people that tend to be more pro-trade. So both parties kind of have a dilemma. And this is also spelled out. You can see partisanship looming here, which is something that I don't like to say. But one of the things people's views on issues, including trade, tend to be colored about who's in the White House. If their guy is in the White House, they tend to, and it is always a guy, I'm sorry to say, they tend to support that person. And if your party is not in the White House, you tend to oppose whatever they're doing. So here you've got Republicans saying that increased tariffs are good for us, and you've got much larger numbers of Democrats saying increased tariffs are bad for us. And now if this exactly the same thing had happened in the Obama administration, you probably would have seen the reverse results here. And you would probably have seen Democrats saying the tariffs are good because Obama did them, and the Republicans saying the tariffs are bad because Obama did them. And here it's the reverse. Trump did them, so the Democrats think that automatically they're bad. So one of the reasons if you want to drill down a little bit more, and then I'm going to stop, why are trade skeptics skeptical? You can look here and see, because they think the trade increases, it increases outsourcing of jobs to other countries, and they think that's bad. They think imports are bad. You can think this is true for 100 years. People think imports are bad, exports are good. And this is not a sophisticated kind of analysis, but they like inbound investment. They don't like outbound investment so much. And they tend to think that free trade agreements are, for the most part, don't always have positive results. Have a positive effect on innovation? Yes. Economic growth? Yes, but less so. Jobs for U.S. workers? You can see that people are much more closely divided about that. And trade gets the blame for a lot of workers. So we are divided on trade, and we are confused on trade, and in part by the pace of all this change keeps us confused. Now, we were talking about this before lunch. Things happen so fast that it's hard for companies to adjust, it's hard for companies to keep up, it's hard for them to anticipate the next move. I told George that at one point, one of the conversations I had with his then boss in the Pentagon was, his boss was complaining that in terms of Pentagon procurement in the information communications technology sector, which is really important to the military, that the procurement process in the Pentagon was longer than the life cycle of the stuff they were buying, which meant that things were obsolete even before they arrived. Now, they've done some things since then to fix that. But we live in a world where that's happening, where the pace of change is moving very, very quickly, and it's hard for people to adjust. 120 years ago, when the automobile rolled along, the buggy whip manufacturers had 20 years to get ready, you know, and to figure out what was going on. In today's technology, you don't have 20 years. You may have 6 months, if you're lucky. And that puts an awful lot of pressure on people to anticipate, to bet right, guess right, and then if you do, you get the rewards. But if you don't, then you have some of the problems that we've been talking about. So with that, I think that I will stop. I hope that's been at least informationally helpful, but I'm happy to take any questions that George wants to give me.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you. Trade is a complicated subject, as you well know. And I think you've done a very good job of kind of explaining some of the basics. While we're gathering questions from our members and guests who are here today, I wanted to ask the first question myself. And that is, when you were talking about examples of manufacturing and things going across borders and parts coming from everywhere, you're talking globalization of the economy. The current populist movements are kind of a reaction to that. I just wanted your views on whether or not we could reverse globalization even if we wanted to. Are we down that road and we got to keep going? Or?
That's a good question. There have been two times in history when globalization actually was reversed. One was the fall of the Roman Empire and the 500 years that followed that, which is probably not a good historical example. The other one was 1913, when World War I broke out. And if you look at data on this subject, the volume of world trade that existed in 1913 was not exceeded again until 1970. And so that was because of two world wars and a depression and a lot of reconstruction in the 50s and 60s. It took that long to get back. So yes, there are cataclysmic events that can occur that push everything backwards. That's the yes part of the answer. The no part of the answer is you're not going to uninvent technology. The internet is here. It's not going to go away. I suppose if we had global power failures and everybody in the world ran out of electricity and we went back to the Stone Age, sure, but that would be an unlikely scenario. So modern technology is here. You know, artificial intelligence is going to continue to be invented, created, improved. Additive manufacturing, which is the fancy term for 3D printing, is going to continue. These things are not going to disappear from human consciousness. And so in that respect, we're going to have to deal with them. The extent to which government regulates them can slow down the process of globalization. And you can see that most dramatically with respect to arguments about regulating digital transmissions and e-commerce and in privacy regulations. If you have privacy regulations that are too strict, what you're going to say is your data has to stay in country. Well, if you're a bank, you're telling the bank you cannot use any of your economies of scale to store all your data in multiple locations or in one location. You have to store your data in every small country where you're doing business. If that's going to be the rule, you're holding back a lot of technological development that would otherwise occur. So governments can slow things down. I don't think they can roll things back.
Mike, yes. Here's a question about winners and losers in the trade world. In your presentation, there appeared to be clear winners and losers in the global supply chain. Please comment on the future trade activity and who the apparent winners and losers are, or where is the supply chain going to shift to and who's going to lose out?
If I knew that, I could make a whole pile of money. I think McKinsey is right that you're going to see more regionalization of supply chains. People want to be closer to their customers. I mean, this fluctuates. There was a 30 years ago, people wanted to be closer to their customers too. And then there were other priorities, other philosophies, but we seem to be moving back to an era where people want to be closer to their customers. And there are localization movements that are sort of incipient, growing. You see it mostly in agriculture, with the people who want local produce and things like that. But there are more and more people saying, I want to have confidence in my whatever it is that I'm buying, and I want to have it, and my confidence is highest if it's produced in the next town. So that doesn't make a trend, but if you add all these little things together, I see some localization, some pulling back, which means more domestic supply chains within countries. For the United States, it means Mexico will be a winner. I think in Asia, Vietnam is already the winner, although they're running into the problem of being a winner, which is their infrastructure constraints. You know, they don't have enough power. They're having power outages. If you want to build a plant in Vietnam, and a lot of people do, you have to think long and hard about whether there's going to be enough electricity to run the plant, because the infrastructure hasn't kept pace with some of the investment. But they're going to be a winner. Down the road, Indonesia, if they ever get organized, will probably be a winner. One of the things that is true in economics, as in other elements of life, is size matters. And if you're big, that makes a difference. You know, if you're Mauritania, you're not going to control the market for much of anything. I'm sorry, but it's 3 million people or whatever, or 2 million people. And if you're India, it's a different story. A lot of people want to go to India, so India has a lot of market power. I think they're squandering it, but that's another story. So big will prosper. Countries that make the right mix of economic decisions will prosper, and they are mostly decisions that will provide certainty, reliability, and ideally rule of law investments. If you're a Westerner who wants to invest, you want to go to a place where things work, okay, where there's enough infrastructure that you can operate with efficiency, and where you have because you know you're going to have commercial disputes, they're inevitable, where there is some sort of adjudication process where that is reasonably objective, efficient, and transparent. You don't have to win all the time, but you don't want to get tied up in 300 lawsuits, each of which is going to take 20 years to resolve. You want to have a country that is efficient. Countries that can make decisions about that make decisions to welcome foreign investment, and then do the things they have to do to put meaning behind that welcoming, they're the ones that are going to prosper. And there's some countries that have done that. Chile has done that. The interesting question is, which countries in Africa are going to do that? Africa has been the next big thing for 30 years. And so we're waiting to see. I'm doing a podcast tomorrow with our Africa expert, and he's going to tell me. There are signs in Ghana and in Kenya that they're figuring it out, and in Ethiopia, actually, that they're figuring it out. But elsewhere, we'll have to wait and see. So there are bright spots here and there, and the good news is that this is not inevitable. Governments can make a difference. Governments can make the right decisions for their people and create more growth and prosperity than would have occurred otherwise. Not every government does that, but they can do that, which is good news.
Here's a question about the effect of consolidation of industries. What are the chances the global economy will one day be owned by just a handful of companies? If so, what would be the consequences?
Well, I think the consequence would be bad. This is why we have antitrust laws and why most developed countries have competition policies of some sort. It's basic economics. Concentration tends to breed inefficiency, higher prices, poorer service. I think one of the questions that we have to deal with is sort of the, which governments have wrestled with in different ways, is kind of the public utility question. Are there industries that constitute a public good where it makes the most sense if everybody has the same thing, if you will? I mean, the United States felt that way about the phone company for 100 years, and then we broke the phone company up. Are we better off now than we were when there was only AT&T or Bell? I don't know. I mean, that's a question you all have to answer. But if you think about it going forward, I mean, the Europeans are wrestling with exactly this question because they're trying to figure out, what do we do about Google? What do we do about Facebook? What do we do about Apple? What do we do about Amazon? Because they don't have those. There are no indigenous European competitors for those industries, and they're upset about that. And this gets a little bit off your question, but it's a relevant point, I think. You know, if you think about the world economically, if you're in a race, if you're in competition, there's only two ways to win. You run faster or you trip the other guy. And sometimes both tactics are appropriate, but the European tactic right now, look at their digital services tax that they proposed. The European tactic right now is, we're going to trip the Americans and hold them back because they got nothing to compete with. It would be a lot smarter for them to develop their own Google, their own Facebook. That's what they did with Airbus. You know, governments can do this if you are willing to devote considerable resources and commit yourself to it. But they're trying to hold us back. Effectively, this is what we're trying to do with the Chinese. We're trying to hold them back, where the answer is, we probably need to think more about how do we run faster, because we're going to have to compete with them. And the issue is not competing with them in China. The issue is competing with them everywhere else where we're going to go head-to-head with them. So I don't see that happening. I don't think the world, if anything, we're getting more fragmented rather than more combined. If you look at the internet, I would say in 10 years, we're going to have three internets, not one. We're going to have European internet, the Chinese internet, and American internet. And everybody else is going to be in one of those orbits, because the three countries are going in. America is kind of confused about where it's going, but Europe and China are going in very different directions in terms of regulation of the internet, and they're not compatible directions. So if anything, we're moving in the opposite direction of more fragmentation.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was William Reinsch, who holds the Skoll Chair in International Business at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He recently spoke with the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations about globalization, inequality, and trade policy. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.